Even the air. I remembered Gwyneth's words. Taravin is not paradise, Leah. Of course Taravin had its own problems. I didn't need Gwyneth to tell me it wasn't perfect. But in Civica, the air itself was tight, waiting to catch you, beat you down, always laced with the scent of watching and warning. Here in Taravin, the air was just air, and whatever it held, it held. It didn't take anyone hostage, and this showed on the townsfolk's faces. They were quicker to smile, wave, call you into a shop for a taste, to share a laugh or a bit of news. The town was filled with ease. Pauline would get over Mikhail. She'd look to the future. Bertie, Gwyneth, and I would help her. And of course, Taravin itself. The home she loved. There wasn't a better place for us to be. With tomorrow, the first day of the festival, remembrances sprang from all corners of the town. Sailors hoisting nets, scrubbing decks, furling sails, favorite verses of this one or that blending effortlessly with their day's work into a song that stirred me in ways the holy songs never had. A natural music. The flap of sails over our heads, the fishmonger calling out a catch, the swash of water lapping sterns, the bells of distant boats hailing one another, a pause, a note, a jangle, a shout, a laugh, a prayer, the swish of a mop, the rasp of a rope. It all became one song, connected in a magical way that strummed through me. Faithful, faithful, hoist there, pull. Pure of heart, pure of mind, holy remnant, blessed above all, rockfish, perch, sablefish, soul, stars and wind, rain and sun, chosen remnant, holy one, day of deliverance, freedom, hope, turn the winch, not the rope, faithful, faithful, blessed above all, salt and sky, fish and gull, lift up your voice, sing the way there. Morrigan leads by mercy of gods, fresh fish, thresher, bluefin, cod. Journey's end through the veil, pull the anchor, set the sail. Morrigan blessed forevermore. I turned down a quiet lane back toward the main road, the layers of songs floating behind me. Evermore, I whispered, feeling the remembrances in a new way. My voice feeling like it was part of something new, maybe something I could understand.
I have you. I have you now.
I looked over my shoulder, the strange, gravelly words out of place among the others. But the bay was far behind me now, the sea carrying away the tunes.
Ho there, lass! A pretty crown for the festival?
I spun. A wrinkled, gap-toothed man sat on a stool outside the chandlery, squinting in the midday sun. He held up an arm draped with cheerful garlands of dried flowers to adorn the head. I stopped to admire them, but was cautious about spending any more money. The bundles I carried had already used up most of the coin I'd earned at the tavern in a month. There were still the gems, of course, and one day I would travel to Luisa Vecchia to exchange them, but that money would be set aside for Pauline. She would need it more than I would, so I had to be careful with what little I had. Still, as I held a garland in my hand, I imagined it on my head at the festival, and Rafe leaning closer to admire a flower or catch its faint scent. I sighed. I knew that wasn't likely to happen. I shook my head and smiled. They're beautiful, I said, but not today.
Only a copper, he offered.
Back in Civica, I'd have thrown a copper into the fountain just for the fun of seeing where it landed. And indeed, a copper was little enough to pay for something so cheery. And the festival did come only once a year. I bought two, one with pink flowers for Pauline's hair, and one with lavender flowers for mine. With my hands now full, I made my way back to the inn, smiling, picturing something more cheerful on Pauline's head than the somber white mourning scarf, though I wasn't sure I could convince her to wear the garland instead. I took the upper road back to the inn, no more than a wide dirt trail, taking advantage of the shade and the quiet. The wind whispered a soothing hush through the pines, while a complaining jay sometimes jarred the peace and a scolding squirrel chirped back. I had a little something extra in my bundle for Walther and Greta, something sweet and lacy and small. I couldn't wait to give it to him. Walther's hands would be so large and clumsy holding it. It made me smile. When did he say he would stop by again?
Be careful, sister. Be careful.
Something cold crouched low in my gut, and I stopped walking. His warning was so close, so immediate, but distant, too. Walther? I called out, knowing he couldn't possibly be here, but I heard the footsteps, but too late. I didn't even have time to turn before I was crushed by an arm across my chest. I was yanked backward, my arms pinned at my sides. A brutal hand clamped down on my wrist. I screamed, but then felt the prick of a knife at my throat and heard a warning not to utter another sound. I could smell him, the stench of rotten teeth on hot breath, oily, unwashed hair, and the overwhelming odor of sweat-soaked clothing, all of it as oppressive as the arm that squeezed me. The knife pressed into my flesh, and I felt the tickle of blood running into the hollow of my neck. "I have no money," I said.
"I'm going to tell you this once only. I want what you stole."
My knife was sheathed beneath my jerkin at my left side, just inches from my fingers, but I couldn't reach up with my left hand to get it, and my right arm was held tight in his grip. If I could just buy some time. "I've stolen many things," I said. "Which one?"
"This knife is courtesy of the scholar and chancellor," he growled. "That should help you remember."
"I didn't take anything of theirs." He shifted his grip, pushing the knife higher so I had to press back against him to avoid having it cut deeper into my skin. I didn't dare breathe or move, even though he loosened his hold on my arm. He produced a piece of paper, shaking it in front of my eyes.
"And this note says different. The scholar told me to tell you he wasn't amused."
I recognized the note. My own. Such an intriguing piece, but tisk, not properly shelved. It is now. I hope you don't mind. "If I give it back, you'll kill me." The only parts of my body I could move were my legs. I gingerly shuffled my right boot along the dirt, trying to find where his foot was positioned behind me. I finally met with something solid. My blood pounded in my ears, every part of me on fire.
"I'm paid to kill you either way," he answered. "But I could make it more painful for you if that's the way you want it. And then there's that pretty friend of yours."
My knee jerked upward, and I stomped down on the top of his foot as hard as I could, my elbow jamming back into his ribs at the same time. I jumped away and whirled at him, pulling out my knife. He was coming at me, grimacing in pain, but then he abruptly stopped. His eyes widened unnaturally, and then his face lost all expression except for his bulging eyes. He crumpled to the ground, falling to his knees. I looked at the knife in my hands, wondering if I had thrust it into him without even knowing it. He fell forward at my feet, face down, his fingers twitching in the dirt. I saw movement. Caden was 10 yards away, a crossbow at his side, Rafe a bit farther behind him. They rushed toward me but stopped a few feet away.
"Leah," Rafe said, holding his hand out. "Give me the knife."
I looked down at the weapon still clutched in my hand, and then back at him. I shook my head. "I'm all right. I brushed my jerkin aside and tried to return the knife to its sheath, but it spilled from my fingers to the ground. Caden retrieved it and slid it into its thin leather casing for me. I stared at what was left of the garlands crushed beneath our feet in the scuffle, tiny pieces of pink and lavender scattered across the forest floor.
"Your neck," Rafe said. "Let me see."
He lifted my chin and wiped at the blood with his thumb. Everything still seemed to be happening in fast, jerky movements. Rafe produced a piece of cloth, a kerchief, and pressed it to my neck.
"We'll have Birdie look at it. Can you hold this here?"
I nodded, and he lifted my hand to my neck, pressing my fingers into the cloth. He walked over and kicked the man's shoulder to make sure he was dead. I knew he was. His fingers were no longer twitching.
"I heard you scream," Caden said, "but I couldn't get a clear shot at him until you pushed away. At this range, the arrow might have gone straight through him into you."
He set his crossbow down and knelt beside the body, breaking off the arrow that protruded from the man's back. Together, he and Rafe rolled him over. We all stared at the man, whose eyes were still open. Blood filled deep creases on either side of his mouth, making him look like a startled puppet. Neither of them seemed affected by his appearance. Perhaps they had examined many dead bodies. I hadn't. My knees weakened.
"Do you know him?" Rafe asked.
I shook my head. Caden stood.
"What did he want?"
"Money," I said automatically, surprising myself. "He just wanted money." I couldn't tell them the truth without revealing who I was. And then I saw the note, the small piece of paper written in my own hand, fluttering only inches from his fingers.
"Do we call the constable?" Caden asked.
"No," I said. "Please don't. I can't." I took a step forward, and my knees melted away, blood rushing behind my eyes, the world spinning. I felt hands catching me, scooping beneath my legs.
"Carry her back. I'll take care of the body."
My head spun, and I tried to breathe deeply, fearing I would retch, a hand holding the cloth to my neck again.
"Breathe, Leah, breathe. You'll be all right."
But with my world spinning, I wasn't sure if the words I heard were Caden's or my own.
Chapter 26. Rafe.
I wrestled with the body, hoisting it across the back of my horse. Blood smeared my shoulder. The smell of decay hadn't set in yet, but I had to turn away from the rank odor of neglect and excrement for a breath of fresh air. That's the way of death. There's no dignity in it. A deep, rugged gorge was just over the ridge. I headed there, leading my horse through the woods. Animals and the elements would take care of the body long before anyone ventured into that remote abyss. It was all he deserved. I couldn't get the image of her bloody neck out of my mind. I had seen plenty of bloody necks before, but ordered by her own father? It was no ordinary bandit who attacked her. This man had been on the road for weeks looking for her. I knew there was a warrant posted for her arrest and a bounty for her return. It had been chattered about in a town I stopped in near Civica when I was searching for her myself. I thought the warrant was only a shallow gesture to appease Dalbric. Just who were the barbarians now? The Vendans or the Moragis? What kind of father ordered his own daughter's murder? Even wolves protect their own cubs. No wonder she ran. Killing in the name of war was one thing. Killing one's own kin was quite another.
Chapter 27.
One free morning. One free morning, and look at the trouble you get into, Bertie said, dabbing at my neck. Caden sat beside me, holding a bucket, in case I retched again. It wasn't as though I went out looking for bandits, I replied. Bertie shot a stern, knowing glance at me. There were no bandits in Taravan, not on an upper remote trail, preying on a girl wearing threadbare clothing who had little money. But with Caden sitting there, she covered for me just the same. With the town full of strangers right now, you have to be more careful. The knife had scraped my neck more than cut it. Bertie said the wound was no bigger than a flea bite, but necks are bleeders. She put a stinging balm on the cut, and I flinched. Hold still, she scolded. I'm fine. Stop making such a fuss over a little. Look at you. Your neck is slashed from here to there. You just said it was no bigger than a flea bite. She pointed to my lap. And you're still shaking like a leaf. I looked down at my knees, bouncing in place. I forced them to stop. When you've tossed up your whole morning meal, you're bound to feel shaky. She didn't ask why I had tossed my morning meal. She knew I wasn't squeamish about blood. But we all carefully skirted the subject of the body. Caden had simply told her Rafe was taking care of it. She didn't ask what that meant. I didn't either. We were just glad that the matter was being taken care of, though I wondered what he'd do with a body if not take it to the constable. But I could still hear the way he said it. He wasn't taking it to the authorities. There was no doubt the dead man was a murderous miscreant. Maybe that was all Rafe needed to know. He saw him holding the knife to my throat and saw the blood running down my neck. Why bother the constable when a convenient ravine was so much closer? Maybe that was the way of distant, nameless regions. If so, I was glad. You're sure there was only one bandit? Bertie asked. Sometimes they rove in bands. I knew she spoke in code, wanting to know if the person who attacked me could have a whole royal army marching down on the inn by the end of the day. He was a lone bandit, I'm certain. There are no others. She breathed out a long, wordless grumble, which I took to be her version of relief. There, she said, pressing a small bandage to my neck. Done. She stirred some powder into a cup of water and held it out to me. Drink this. It will help settle your stomach. I drank dutifully, hoping to appease her. Now, off to your bed to rest, she said. I'll bring some bread and broth along shortly. I was about to protest, but Caden grabbed my elbow to help me up, and as I stood, I felt the effects of the violent struggle just now settling in. Every part of me ached. My shoulder, my elbow that had jabbed his ribs, my ankle and heel that had stomped down with incredible force, my neck that had twisted back farther than it could naturally go. Just for a little while, I said. I'll be able to work in the dining room tonight. Bertie mumbled something under her breath, and Caden led me out the kitchen door. As we climbed up the hillside steps, I thanked him for his timely appearance, saying I would surely be dead if he hadn't come along, and asked how he came to be there. I heard a scream, grabbed my bow, and ran toward the forest. I thought it was Pauline returning from the sacrista, and she had encountered an animal, a bear or panther. I didn't expect to see you with a knife at your throat. It was the last thing I expected, too. I'm thankful your aim was sure. And the body, will that...
It will disappear, he said confidently.
It's just that I'm new here myself, I explained, and I don't want to cause problems for Bertie. I'm already on the bad side of some soldiers.
I understand. No one will know. The man deserves no better.
He seemed as eager as I was to have any trace of the encounter gone.
He'd killed the man only to save me. No one could blame him for that. But perhaps he couldn't afford questions from a constable right now any more than I could. We reached the cottage door, but he still held my arm to support me. "Should I see you inside?" he asked. He was steady and even, as he always was. Except for the brief fit when Rafe's horse bit him, nothing seemed to ruffle him, even the terror of today. His eyes rested on me, two warm circles of brown. And yet they betrayed him, just as they had on that night in the tavern when I first met him. Though composure ruled on the outside, a strange tempest stirred inwardly. He reminded me of Bryn in so many ways, the youngest and wildest of my three brothers. Bryn was always clever enough to put on the correct royal airs in my father's presence to deflect any suspicion of his misconduct. But my mother could always pinch his chin, look into his eyes, and the truth was revealed. I just couldn't figure out Caden's truth yet. "Thank you, but I'm steady now," I answered. But even as I stood there, I didn't feel so steady. I was drained. It was as if a week's worth of energy had been dispatched in just a few quick moments of trying to survive. "You're sure there were no others?" he asked. "No one else that you saw?" "I'm certain." I couldn't explain that I knew bounty hunters didn't run in packs, and this one especially was on a private mission. His hand slid from my arm, and I was grateful. Bertie was right. I did need to rest. I closed the door behind me, took off my bloody shirt, and threw it in the corner. I was too tired to be worried about washing it just now. I sat on the bed, wincing at the pain in my shoulder and neck, then fluffed my pillow, tucking my knife beneath it. I would do as I promised Walther, practice, no matter how early I had to rise. No one would take me by surprise again, but for now, a short rest was all I needed. My eyelids grew heavier. What had Bertie given me in that water? I slept heavily, but remembered Bertie coming into the cottage, sitting on the edge of the bed to say something to me, brushing the hair from my forehead with her hand, and quietly leaving again. I sniffed the aroma of freshly baked bread and chicken broth coming from the table next to me, but I was too tired to eat, and fell back asleep until I heard a soft knock on the door. I sat up, disoriented. The sun was peeking through the west window. I had slept the whole afternoon. Another tap. "Bertie?"
"It's only me. I'll just leave this out here."
"No, wait," I called. I jumped up and limped to the door, my ankle more painfully stiff now than it had been earlier. Rafe stood there with his finger hooked through the strings of the two bundles I had dropped in the forest. I took them from him and set them on the bed, and when I turned to face him again, he was holding out two delicate garlands, one pink, one lavender.
"I think these are like the ones you had."
I bit my lip and then finally whispered a small, inadequate thank you as he placed them in my hands. An awkward moment passed, both of us looking at each other, looking away, and then looking back again.
"Your neck?"
he finally asked, turning his head to the side to look at my bandage. I remembered how, only hours ago, his thumb slid across my skin as he held his kerchief to the wound. "Bertie said the cut was no bigger than a flea bite, mostly a bad scrape."
"But you're limping."
I rubbed my shoulder. "I hurt all over."
"You fought hard."
"I had no choice," I said. I stared at his clothes. He had changed. No trace of a corpse's blood or the method he used to take care of the body. I was afraid to ask, but also afraid not to. "The body?"
"Don't ask, Leah. It's done. I nodded. He started to leave, then stopped himself.
I'm sorry.
For what? I asked.
I wish I...
He shook his head.
Just sorry,
he repeated, and left down the path. Before I could call after him, I spotted Pauline coming toward the cottage. I ducked back inside, grabbed my bloodied shirt from the floor, and looked for a place to hide it. In our small quarters, that could only mean the wardrobe. I flung open the door and stuffed the shirt into the dark corner, pushing some other things in front of it. I'd retrieve it later to be washed. Pauline had enough worries in her life right now without me adding to them. Among the clutter in the bottom, I spotted the basket Walther had given me. I had been so consumed with the news he had brought that day, I had hastily tucked it away and forgotten it. He'd said he put a morsel in the bottom to tide me over, but surely it was spoiled by now. I imagined more of the lovely fig cheese gone to waste, and braced myself for the smell as I pushed aside the napkin covering the bottom. It wasn't fig cheese. The door flew open, and I spun to face Pauline. "What happened to your neck?" she demanded immediately. "A little tumble down the stairs with some firewood in my arms. Pure clumsiness." She slammed the door behind her. "That's Enzo's job. Why were you doing it?" I looked at her, perplexed. It was the most engaged she had been in 2 weeks. The laggard wasn't around today. Every time he comes into a bit of coin, he disappears. She started to go on about my bandage, but I stopped her and drew her to the bed to show her the basket. We sat, and I noticed her scarf was gone. Her hair was full and honey gold around her shoulders. "Your morning scarf," I said. "It's time to move on," she explained. "I've done all I can for my Mikhail. Now I have other things that require my attention. And the first thing appears to be you." I reached out and hugged her, pulling her tightly to me. My chest shook. I tried not to make a display, but I held her long and hard until she finally eased away, cautiously looking me over. "Is everything all right?" Weeks of worry poured out of me, my voice shaking. "Oh, Pauline, I missed you so much. You're all I have. You're my family now. And you were so pale and grieved. I feared I might never get you back. And then there were the tears and the silence. The silence." I stopped, pressing my fingers to my lips, trying to force the quiver away. "The silence was the worst of it all. I was afraid when you told me to go away that you blamed me for Mikhail." She pulled me toward her, holding me, and we both cried. "I'd never blame you for that," she said. She leaned back so she could look into my eyes. "But grief has a way of its own, Leah. A way I can't control. I know it's not over yet, but today at the Sacrista..." She paused, blinking back tears. "Today, I felt something. A flutter inside. Here." She took my hand and pressed it low against her stomach. "I knew it was time for me to prepare for the living." Her eyes glistened. Through all the pain, I saw the hope of joy in her eyes. My throat swelled. This was a journey neither of us could have imagined. I smiled and wiped my cheeks. "There's something I need to show you," I said. I put the basket between us and moved aside the napkin, pulling out a fat roll of Morrigan notes, a morsel that was supposed to tide me over for some time to come. My brother would understand. "Walther brought this. It was Mikhail's. He said Mikhail left a letter saying it was for you if anything should happen to him." Pauline reached out and touched the thick roll. "So much from a first-year sentry? He managed his purse well, I said, knowing any good trait assigned to Mikhail would be easily accepted by Pauline. She sighed, and a sad smile lined her eyes.
That was Mikhail. This will help.
I reached out and held her hand.
We'll all help, Pauline. Bertie, Gwyneth, and I will all be here for... Do they know? She asked.
I shook my head. Not yet. But we both knew. Either time would tell them, or Pauline would. Some truths refused to be hidden.
Tell me again, Amma, about the warmth before. The warmth came, child, from where? I don't know. My father commanded, and it was there. Was your father a god? Was he a god? It seemed so. He looked like a man. But he was strong beyond reason, knowledgeable beyond possible, fearless beyond mortal, powerful as a... Let me tell you the story, child. The story of my father. Once upon a time, there was a man as great as the gods. But even the great can tremble with fear. Even the great can fall. The Last Testaments of Gadrell. Chapter 28.
A pink sugar haze glazed the sky, and the sun began its climb over the mountain. Either side of the road was crowded 20 deep, with everyone in Taravan waiting to be led in the procession that would hail the beginning of the holy days. A reverent hum ruffled through the crowd, holiness incarnate, as if the gods stood among us. Maybe they did. The festival of deliverance had begun. In the middle of the road, waiting to lead the crowds, were dozens of women and girls, old and young, hand in hand, dressed in rags. Every first daughter of Taravan. Bertie and Pauline were among them. It was the same procession my mother had led in Civica, that she would lead there today. The same procession that I had walked in just steps behind my mother, because we were the kingdom's first daughters, blessed even above the others, holding within us the strongest gift of all. The same procession, sometimes immense, sometimes attended only by a handful of the faithful, was taking place in towns, hamlets, and villages all over Morrigan. I scanned the faces of the first daughters lining up, the expectant, the confident, the curious, the resigned, some supposing themselves to have the gift, others knowing they didn't, some still hoping it might come. But most taking their places in the middle of the road simply because they knew no other way. It was tradition. The priests made a last call for any other first daughters to join the rest. Gwyneth stood wedged beside me in the crowd. I heard her sigh. I shook my head. And then the singing began. Morrigan's song rose and fell in gentle, humble notes, a plea to the gods for guidance, a chorus of gratitude for their clemency. We all fell in step behind them, dressed in our own rags, our stomachs rumbling because it was a day of fasting, and we made our way to the sacrista for holy sacraments, thanksgiving, and prayer. I thought Rafe and Caden hadn't come. Since it was a day of fasting, Bertie hadn't put out morning fare, and neither of them had stirred from the loft this morning. But just before we reached the sacrista, I spotted them both in the crowd. So did Gwyneth. Heads were bowed, voices only lifted in song, but she sidled close and whispered, "They're here," as if their presence was as miraculous as the gods leading the remnant from destruction. Maybe it was. Suddenly, Gwyneth surged ahead until she was in step with little Simone and her parents. Simone's mother's hair was a sprinkling of salt and pepper, and her father's was snowy white, both old to be parents of such a young child. But sometimes heaven brought unexpected gifts. Holding Simone's hand, the woman nodded acknowledgement over her head to Gwyneth, and they all walked together. I noted that even little Simone, always so impeccably dressed when I had seen her on my errands in town, had managed to find rags to wear. And then, walking just a few paces behind them, I noticed for the first time that Simone's bouncing strawberry curls were only a shade lighter than Gwyneth's. We reached the sacrista, and the crowd spread out. The sanctuary was large, but not big enough to hold all of Taravan, along with the swell of visitors who had come for the High Holy Days. The elderly and the first daughters were invited into the sanctuary, but the rest had to find places on its perimeters. The steps, the plaza, the small grotto court, or the graveyard where additional priests would call rites for all to hear. The crowd thinned, everyone finding a place where they'd spend most of the day in prayer. I hung back, hoping, but I had lost sight of Wraith and Caden. I finally walked to the graveyard, the last place there was anywhere left to kneel. I laid my mat down and caught the gaze of the priest on the back steps of the sacrista. He looked at me, waiting. I didn't know him. I had never met him, but with all the time Pauline had spent at the sacrista, maybe she had told him something. Even if she had confessed our truths, I knew priests were bound by the seal of silence. He continued to observe me, and once I knelt, he began calling rites, beginning with the story of devastation. I knew the story. I had it memorized. Everyone did. Lest we repeat history, the stories shall be passed from father to son, from mother to daughter. The story was told in every hovel, every cramped cottage, every grand manor, the older passing it on to the younger. Regan liked to tell it to me, and often did, though his version was decidedly spicier than Mother's, with more blood, battles, and wild beasts. Aunt Cloris generously peppered hers with obedience, and Aunt Burnett's prominently featured the adventure of the deliverance. But it was all essentially the same story, and not that different from the one the priest told now. The ancients thought themselves only a step lower than the gods, proud in their power over heaven and earth. They controlled night and day with their fingertips. They flew among the heavens. They whispered, and their voices boomed over mountaintops. They were angry, and the ground shook with fear. I tried to concentrate on the story, but when he said the word fear, it triggered my own. I saw again the deathly blank stare of a bloody-jointed puppet, the one that had haunted my dreams last night, telling me, "Don't utter another word." Even in my dreams, I had disobeyed and called out. Silence wasn't my strong point. I'd always known the Chancellor and Scholar disliked me, but I never thought they'd send someone to murder me. A bounty hunter was required to bring the accused back to face justice for acts of treason. This was no bounty hunter. He could have taken me back alive to face execution. Was it possible that Father was part of their plan, eager to be quietly done with me once and for all? "Not your own father," Pauline had said. I wasn't so sure anymore. I shook my head, recalling that night I had slinked into the scholar's study. Why had I left the note? I knew it would only fuel his fury, but I hadn't cared. It didn't bring me joy yesterday to see it clenched in the hand of my attacker, but the gods save me, I had laughed out loud when I wrote it using the scholar's own stationery. He'd have known who did it, even if I hadn't left a note. I was the only possible thief in the Citadel. But I wanted him to realize it was my plan that he should know. I could just imagine the Chancellor's face when the scholar showed the note to him. Even if the books were of no value, by leaving the note, I had raised the ante. Besides fleeing their carefully arranged marriage, I had taunted them. Unthinkable. They were the most powerful people in my father's cabinet, alongside the vice-regent. But I had showed them both I had little regard for their power or position. Leaving the note gave me some power back. I held something over them. Their secrets weren't so well hidden now, even if this secret was something as small as an old book they had failed to properly enter into the royal archive. Last night, after Pauline had fallen asleep, I pulled the chair to the wardrobe. Standing on it, I reached over the raised scrolling at the top and felt for the box I had wrapped in cloth. Why I had stored it up there, I wasn't sure. Maybe because the scholar had hidden it away, I thought I should do the same. These books were not for everyone's eyes. I took the fragile volumes out and laid them on the table. The lantern cast the already yellowed pages in a warm golden glow. Both were thin, small books, bound in soft embossed leather that showed signs of damage, burn marks on the edges as though they had been tossed in a fire. One was more heavily charred than the other, and its last page was missing almost in its entirety, appearing to have been hastily ripped away, except for a few letters in the upper corner. The other book was written in a strange scrawling style I had never seen before. Neither was similar to any of the dialects of Morrigan that I knew of, but there were many obscure tongues that had died out. I guessed these strange words were one of the lost languages. I had turned the brittle pages carefully, studying them for an hour, but in spite of my facility for languages, I made no progress. Some words seemed to have the same roots as Morrigan's words, but even seeing these similar root words wasn't enough. I needed a more in-depth key, and the only archive in Taravin was at the Sacrista. I thought I might have to become friendly with the clerics here. The priest came down the steps, walking among the worshippers, calling out more of the story, his voice strong and ardent. They coveted knowledge, and no mystery was hidden from them. They grew strong in their knowledge, but weak in their wisdom, craving more and still more power, crushing the defenseless. The gods saw their conceit and the emptiness of their hearts, so they sent the angel Astor to pluck a star from the sky and plunge it to the earth, the dust and seas rising so high they choked the unrighteous. But a few were spared, not those strong of body or mind, but those of pure and humble heart. I thought of Pauline. No one more pure and humble of heart than she, which made her prey to the darkest of hearts. Though it was the holiest of days, I let a mumbled curse escape under my breath for Mikhail. An older woman near me smiled, thinking my earnest muttering marked me as devout. I returned her smile and turned my attention back to the priest. Only a small remnant of the whole earth remained. They endured 3 generations of testing and trial, winnowing the purest from those who still turned to darkness. The dark of heart they cast deeper into the devastation. But one, alone, first daughter of Herrick, a humble and wise girl named Morrigan, found special favor in the sight of the gods. To her they showed the path of safety, so she could lead the chosen remnant to a place where the earth was healed, a place where creation could begin anew. Morrigan was faithful to their guidance, and the gods were pleased.
She was given in marriage to Aldred, and forevermore, Morrigan's daughters and all generations of first daughters were blessed with the gift as a promise and remembrance that the gods would never again destroy the earth, as long as there were pure hearts to hear them. The rites continued through midday until the first daughters administered the breaking of the fast, just as the young girl Morrigan had done so long ago when she led the hungry to a place of plenty. I spotted Pauline on the shadowed portico steps, placing bread in the hands of worshippers, and Bertie on another side of the sacrista doing the same. Another first daughter served me, and when the last piece of bread was distributed, at the priest's direction, everyone partook together. By this point, my knees ached and my stomach was rolling with curses, bellowing at the insultingly small morsel of bread. When the priest said the parting words, "So shall it be," everyone woke up and offered a resounding "forevermore." The worshippers rose slowly, stiff from a long day of prayer, ready to return to their homes for the traditional and full breaking of the fast. I walked back alone, wondering where Caden and Rafe had gone. I stretched my shoulder, wincing. There was still work to be done at the inn for the evening meal. It was a holy feast, and most observed it at home. Many of the out-of-town worshippers attended the public meal offered at the sacrista, so only a few guests of the inn would likely dine there. The fare was roasted pigeon, nuts, bush beans, berries, wild greens, all eaten from a community dish, the same as the first simple meal that Morrigan had served the chosen remnant. But there were other ceremonial details that had to be attended to, especially preparation of the dining room. As much as my stomach rumbled for food, my bruised body yearned for a hot bath, and I wasn't sure which I craved more. The last small climb to the inn did particular injustice to my ankle. Between food and a bath, I thought of Rafe and the garlands he had brought. Bringing me the dropped bundles was one thing, but the effort to find the same garlands to replace the crushed ones still mystified me, especially with the other vile task he'd had to attend to. He was so hard to understand. One moment his eyes were full of warmth, the next ice cold. One minute he was attentive, the next he brushed me off and walked away. What battled inside of him? Replacing the garlands was a gesture beyond kindness. There was unspoken tenderness in his eyes when he held them out to me. Why couldn't I?
You're still limping.
Warmth flooded through me, my joints becoming loose and hot all at once. His voice was soft in my ear, his shoulder casually brushing mine. I didn't turn to look at him, only felt him keeping step with me, staying close. "You're devout after all," I said.
"Today I had need to speak to the gods," he answered. "The sacrista was as good a place as any."
"You went to offer thanks?" He cleared his throat.
"No. My anger."
"You're so brave that you would shake your fist at the gods?"
"It's said the gods honor a truthful tongue. So do I."
I looked at him sideways. People lie every day, especially to the gods.
He grinned. Truer words were never said.
"And which god did you pray to?"
"Does it matter? Don't they all hear?"
I shrugged. "Capsius is the god of grievances."
"Then it must have been he who listened.
I'm sure his ears are burning right now." Rafe laughed, but I stared straight ahead. There was no god of grievances called Capsius. The gods had no names at all, only attributes. The god of creation, the god of compassion, the god of redemption, and the god of knowledge. Rafe wasn't devout. He wasn't even learned in the most fundamental tenets of Morrigan holy truths.
Did he come from such a backward place they didn't even have a small sacrista? Maybe that was why he didn't want to talk about his roots. Maybe he was ashamed.
Chapter 29. The Prince.
I had spotted Enzo in the crowds just as we were arriving at the sacrista. I surprised him, moving in close and clamping down on his arm. I made it clear with the tilt of my head that we were taking a little detour. We needed to talk. The sweat sprang to his brow instantly. At least he had the good sense to be worried. I took him a fair distance away from the crowds, in case he was as much of a sniveling fool as I suspected. When we were out of sight, I slammed him up against the wall of the smithy. He raised his fists for a moment to fight back, and then thought better of it, erupting in indignant wails. I pushed him back against the wall so hard it shuddered. "Shut up and listen to every word I say, because the next time we meet like this, one of us will be leaving without a tongue. Do you understand what I'm saying?" He nodded his head wildly, babbling yes over and over. "Good. I'm glad we understand each other." I leaned close and spit out each word clear and low. "I was in the loft yesterday morning. I heard you talking to someone, and I heard you give directions to the upper road." I paused, glaring long and hard. "And then I heard the jingle of coins." His eyes grew wide in horror. "I never want another word about Leah to pass from your lips. And if one word should escape, even by chance, I'll stuff every coin that's in your greedy little palm down your throat right before I cut out your tongue. Do you understand me, Enzo?" He nodded, his mouth firmly sealed shut in case I decided to make good on my threat now. "And this will remain just between us. Understood?" He nodded vigorously again. "Good fellow," I said, and patted his shoulder. I left him cowering against the wall. When I was a few yards away, I turned to face him again. "And Enzo, just so you know," I added cheerfully, "there's no place on this continent where you can hide from me if I choose to find you. Wipe your nose now. You'll be late for the sacraments." He stood there, still frozen. "Now!" I yelled. He wiped his nose and ran, circling wide around me. I watched him disappear down the lane. "Don't make matters worse." It seemed they already were. If only I had been brave enough to refuse the marriage in the first place, she never would have had to run. She never would have had a knife held to her throat. She never would have had to work at an inn with a slimy lout like Enzo. If I had acted so she didn't have to, everything would be different. "Don't tell her who you are. Don't make matters worse for Dalbrek or your fellow soldiers. If I stayed here much longer, everyone would find out. Sooner or later, I would slip." Sven was smarter than I gave him credit for. He had known things would go wrong, but how could I have known that Leah would turn out to be someone so very different from the person I expected?
Chapter 30. The Assassin.
I sensed them long before I saw them. It was the settling, my mother had called it. The balance of thought and intent pushing its way into new places, finding a place to settle, displacing the air. It made your fingertips tingle, your hair rise on your neck. It reached into your heart and added a beat. And if you were practiced, it spoke to you. The settling was strongest when those thoughts and intents were foreign, out of place, or urgent. And there was no one more out of place or urgent in Terevin than Grizz, Malik, Eben, and Finch. I skimmed the heads of the crowd, and Grizz's head easily loomed above the others. He wore his cap pulled low to shadow his face. His scars were a sure way to make small children shriek and grown men pale. When I was certain he'd seen me too, I wove my way through the crowd and slipped down a quiet lane, knowing they'd follow. When we were a safe distance away, I spun around.
"Are you nicked in the head? What are you doing here?"
"How long does it take to part a girl from her noggin?" Finch growled.
"You're early, and there have been complications."
"Curse it," Grizz said. "Pop her head tonight and let's go."
"I'll do it,"
Eben said. I shot Eben a menacing glare and looked back at Grizz.
"I'm still getting information. It might be useful to the Komazar."
Grizz squinted and raised a suspicious, scarred brow.
"What kind of information?"
"Give me one more week. The job will be done and we'll meet when and where I told you. Don't show your faces here again."
"A week," Finch moaned.
Malik looked around dramatically.
"Must be quite agreeable sleeping in a bed, eating hot food out of a real pot and enjoying who knows what other pleasures. I might like to share in some of—"
"One week," I repeated. "But I can always tell the Komazar you were impatient, and I had to forego information that would benefit Venda." Malik glared.
"I think it's more than information you're getting."
"What of it?" I taunted. Malik had never made a secret of his contempt for me. The feeling was mutual. He was jealous of my favored status with the Komazar and of my quarters in the Fortress Tower instead of the Council Wing where he lived. I disliked his overly zealous methods, but he was capable in his duties, deadly, shrewd, and loyal. He had covered my back more than once, for Venda's sake, if not mine. Grizz stomped away without any more words to me, cuffing Eben on the back of the head as he left.
"Let's go."
Finch grumbled. He was the only one among us who had a wife at home. He had reason to begrudge any further waiting. We had all been gone for the better part of a year. Malik rubbed the finely trimmed hair on his jaw, scrutinizing me before he turned and followed the others.
1 week.
I had pulled it out of thin air.
1 week would make no difference. There was no information, no reason to delay. In 7 days, I would slit Leah's throat, because Venda meant more to me than she did. Because the Komazar had saved me when no one else would. I couldn't leave this job undone. She was one of them, and one day she would return to them. But for now, I had 7 more days.
Chapter 31.
"It wouldn't hurt to add a little swing to your step when you walk in there," Gwyneth said, tilting her head toward the kitchen door. Pauline immediately voiced her disapproval.
"This is a holy meal, Gwyneth."
"And a celebration," Gwyneth countered as she slid 6 roasted pigeons from the spit onto platters. "How do you think all those first daughters came to be born from the remnant? My bet's that Morrigan knew how to swing her hips." Pauline rolled her eyes and kissed her fingers as penance for Gwyneth's sacrilege. I let out an exasperated sigh. "I am not flirting with anyone."
"Haven't you already?" Gwyneth asked.
I didn't answer. Gwyneth had witnessed my frustration as I came in the kitchen door. Once again, Rafe had gone from attentive and warm to distant and cold as soon as we reached the inn. I'd slammed the kitchen door behind me, and I'd said under my breath, "What is wrong with him?" Gwyneth heard my grumbling.
I tried to cover by saying I was talking about Enzo, but she would have none of it. What about the blonde one? What's the matter with him? Nothing's the matter with him. Why are you...
I actually think he has kinder eyes, Pauline said. And his voice is...